WCCO and Twin City Federal present Minnesota Milestone, the 32nd Star, the story of government and politics. They heard in those days, they heard in the far-off lands beyond the great sea. They heard of a land of equality where the people ruled themselves free of the iron hand of the despot. Could it be true? Was there such a land? A land of democracy, it was called. A land of opportunity. A land of political and economic freedom. And they came by the thousands, by the millions, to the New World's shores, to the land of Minnesota, these millions yearning to breathe the air of freedom. This story, perhaps the most fascinating in all the history of Minnesota, this is the story of men and women and their minds, a story of the governments they forged from the crude iron of a raw frontier. I am E.W. Zeebarth.
I am Cedric Adams.
And I am Bob DeHaven.
This is program number 9 in a series of 12 special hour-long broadcasts which WCCO is dedicating to Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. This year-long series, presented by WCCO Radio and Twin City Federal, is called Minnesota Milestones. And the story, our government, our politics. It's a story of the town meeting, the county seat squabble, the founding of the state itself, of opinions melted white hot in the crucible of debate, campaigns, elections, suffrage, county option. This is the story of free men breathing free air.
The chugging, tooting steamboats brought them up the rivers. They came in wagon trains with the dust rising from the wheels and the horses' hooves into the white patched sky. Yes, the settlers came, all varieties, the Irish and the Germans, the English and the Scandinavians. And each group, each nationality, preferred to live in splendid isolation with its own kind at first. Irish spoke only to Irish, Norwegian only to Norwegian, just the way it had been in the old country. And that's the way it was when the Sigurd Olsen family crossed the Mississippi back in the 1840s and settled west of St. Anthony. Sigurd's nearest neighbor, 2 miles away, Mike Flaherty and his family, as staunchly Irish and Catholic as Sigurd was Scandinavian and Protestant. Neither family had much to do with the other at first, and yet they were soon brought into a close association that would last through the lifetimes of both Sigurd and Mike, through the lives of their children and their children's children. And what brought them together? Self-government. Self-government of 36 square miles of land, the township, and the town meeting where mutual problems were solved. That was the place where Mike and Sigurd came to know each other well.
And I'm telling you, I don't care if these people are coming in here with a lot of legal-looking papers signed by some politician in St. Paul. We settled here. We cleared this land. We broke the sod, and they haven't any right chasing us off this land.
Yeah, and I'm standing behind every word Mike says. Now, these new settlers, why can't they settle their own lands?
Mike and Sigurd were concerned about a problem rather common in early day Minnesota. They had settled on land before it was officially opened for farming. And settlers coming later obtained official title to land that was technically unoccupied. And when the territorial officials ordered an auction of Mike's and Sigurd's lands, tried to auction the land of their neighbors, they met with stubborn resistance born of political cooperation.
Yes, from the very first, settlers found that together they were strong. And from this realization grew cooperation and the beginnings of self-government. That was one reason why they had tearfully left old home ties, crossed a vast ocean, traveled across dusty plains, and settled in a new land, so they could live as free men. And now, in 1848, Wisconsin became a state, with western boundaries at the St. Croix River. A new thriving area, the area between the St. Croix and the Mississippi, an important triangle of land, was left without government. And men seeking to govern themselves hastened to fill the vacuum. Prominent citizens of St. Paul, Stillwater, and the other river towns gathered at Stillwater.
Now, you all know why we are here today. We have no legal government. That is, we're not recognized in any way in Washington. What we need is a prominent citizen to go to Washington to plead our case before the Congress and tell them that Minnesota is ready to be admitted as a territory. And to represent us, I can think of no man better fitted than the first citizen of Mendota, Henry Hastings Sibley.
So Henry Sibley traveled to Washington, where he presented the issue so forcefully that Congress consented. And some forward-looking individuals began to think and to dream of Minnesota as a state, as the 32nd star in the United States flag. The opinion was by no means unanimous.
Now, I don't see any sense at all in this statehood business. The way it is now, Washington pays for the running of our government.
But others argued differently, including the man who was territorial governor at the time, Willis A. Gorman. He came out in favor of statehood most emphatically in his message to the legislature in 1857.
I say to you, we cannot afford to remain a territory. The cost in terms of our future would be far greater. As a territory, we have no vote in Congress. We are prohibited from borrowing money. As a territory, we are unable to obtain the land grants necessary for building a railroad to the Pacific through Minnesota. There is no great interest in which Minnesota has so heavy a stake to win or lose as in the Pacific Railroad.
In February 1857, Congress passed the Enabling Act that gave the people of Minnesota Territory permission to write a constitution and form a state. An election was held the 1st of June, and in July, 114 delegates arrived in St. Paul to write a constitution for the new state of Minnesota. But an almost even split, 59 Republicans and 55 Democrats, produced bitter fighting, and the Constitutional Convention quickly became a pitched battle. The convention was to meet at noon on July 13th. The Republicans were afraid that if the Democrats gained control of the convention, some Republicans would not be seated, and therefore the party would not be properly represented. So they assigned several Republicans to sleep in the Capitol all night. During the morning, a workman entered the hall, mounted a ladder, and proceeded to regulate the clock. The Republican watchers paid no attention. The date was July 13th. The convention was to meet at noon. They were amazed, therefore, when at 17 minutes before noon, by the clock on the wall, in marched the Democrats en masse. And before the bulk of the Republicans could be assembled, Secretary of the Territory Charles L. Chase, a Democrat, quickly stepped to the speaker's platform. Seeing what was happening, John W. North of the Republican group also leaped to the rostrum.
The Constitution for the proposed state of Minnesota is now in order. Will the delegates please take their seats?
I hereby declare this convention shall be in order for the office of temporary president of this convention. Mr. North, you are out of order, sir. I nominate for the office of temporary president. Mr. North, does not recognize your presence on the rostrum. Member of the Republican Party.
Mr. North.
Thomas Galbraith.
Mr. North, will you please?
Then up jumped the Democrats' leader, Willis Gorman.
I demand recognition. I move this convention shall adjourn until tomorrow, the 14th of July, and shall reconvene at 12 noon.
And in the confusion, many of the Republicans joined the Democrats in voting for Gorman's motion to adjourn. That brought on more wrangling. The Democrats contending that since the motion had been recognized by the Democratic chairman, the Republicans in voting on it had in effect acknowledged Chase as their convention chairman and had accepted Democratic control of the convention organization. Then another comic opera scene. The Democrats returned to the hall the next morning at 9 o'clock, only to find it locked. Secretary Chase spoke.
I demand the use of this hall for the Constitutional Convention of the Territory of Minnesota.
The Constitutional Convention is already in session. You're interfering with the business of the Territory of Minnesota.
The hall from which the delegates adjourned yesterday is now occupied by a meeting of citizens of the Territory who refused to give possession to the Constitutional Convention.
Mr. Chairman, I move this legally constituted group of delegates convene to the council chamber.
I've never seen it.
And so through the hot days of July and August, the Democrats and Republicans met separately, drafting separate copies of a proposed constitution. At last, a committee was appointed with members from both factions to work out a single draft. But two copies were made, and each convention insisted on having its own copy to sign. So at last, on August 28, 1857, the Constitution was approved. Today, Minnesota is unique among states. It has two original copies of its state constitution. Differences are mostly in punctuation, and the two copies have been accepted as one constitution from the very beginning. That fall, there was a bitterly contested election, and Henry Sibley was chosen the first governor, even though Minnesota was not yet a state. The legislature met on December 2, 1857, elected two United States senators, proposed two amendments to the state constitution, and adjourned, months before Minnesota became a state. Finally, on the 11th of May, 1858, the Congress of the United States approved the admission of Minnesota to the Union. The first word was received at Winona, and the cannon boomed. The news did not reach St. Paul until the 13th of May, and the citizens noisily celebrated the happy occasion. Proclaimed the St. Paul Minnesotian of May 14th, "We are a state of the Union, no longer outside barbarians. We are within the Chinese wall of the Confederacy and have donned our freedom suit.
Hail, therefore, to the state of Minnesota. We predict that the next 9 years will see her with probably 500,000 people dwelling happily upon her smiling plains. And with a tenfold great advance in wealth, so may it be."
Minnesota, the 32nd star. In a moment, the story of how the town of St. Paul became the capital of Minnesota on Minnesota Milestones.
Along about this time of year, with old Dame Nature showing forth in all her splendor, folks traditionally think about storing up for lean times, which might lie ahead. Few of us have apple barrels or fruit cellars anymore, but all of us can have savings accounts, safe and growing savings accounts, with which to harvest security. More than 100,000 thrifty persons in our Northwest save at Twin City Federal. Twin City Federal, where their savings are so safe and where they always earn a liberal return. Twin City Federal accounts are insured for safety by the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, a permanent agency of the United States government. And Twin City Federal's current dividend rate is 3.5%, compounded quarterly, the top rate in town on insured savings. Why not stop in at Twin City Federal? Or if you're from out of town, write in. Start saving. Start harvesting security with a safe and prospering savings account where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. For you folks within driving distance, remember, there's plenty of free parking for you right at Twin City Federal's door.
Now, something's got to be done about that road goes past Seeger's in my place. Maybe we put in a box culvert by the creek.
Don't know if we can do it this summer. Road tax money ain't been coming in so good. The times has been pretty hard, you know.
Well, I got some gravel in a wash on my back 40. Maybe if we got 3 or 4 teams and wagons, we could fill it up so it would last till spring.
Yeah, and then we could drag it good. Spring thaw would wash it out, probably. By then, maybe we could get around to putting in the culvert.
Yeah, well, I think that's a pretty good idea.
Mike and Sigurd sat together with other men on the town board, discussing problems peculiar to town boards all over the state. The endless problem of the roads, muddy, rutted, washed out. Each farmer contributing his time, his labor, and his team to haul the old split log road drag, hard maple or elm timbers, bolted together and weighed down with rocks. Common problems requiring cooperative effort of a common solution.
And all over the state, men were being drawn closer together, welded into compact little political units. And through the town boards, thousands of them, the rural area held political control in the early days. The farmer was king, and the political leaders at the state capitol bowed to his will. But there were times, a few times, when the political leaders thwarted the will of certain groups of the voters, and one such incident, Joe Rolette, wily fur trader and political leader Joe Rolette, and the attempt to move the state capitol. Citizens of St. Paul were shocked, back in the winter of 1857, to learn that the territorial senate, called the council in those days, had voted 8-7 in favor of moving the state capitol to St. Peter. Indignant editorials were published in the newspapers, but to no avail. The Territorial House of Representatives approved the capital removal bill, which now had only to be signed into law. St. Paul residents became desperate. That's the point at which Joe Rolette, the council member from Pembina, entered the drama-charged situation. Since he was chairman of the Committee on Re-enrolled Bills, the removal measure was entrusted to his care the afternoon of February 27th, 1857. The next day, consternation in the territorial legislature.
Yeah, let's take this session.
Joseph Rolette! Joseph Rolette!
Where is that guy?
If the gentleman from Pembina's in the House chambers, will he please acknowledge the chair?
Mr. Chairman!
The chair recognizes the gentleman from St. Paul.
I understand Mr. Rolette has been delayed temporarily. I move for a call of the council.
The gentleman from St. Paul requests a call of the council. If passed, this motion will have the effect of halting the council proceedings until all missing members are seated. Discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those contrary will say no. The ayes have it, motion's carried.
Mr. Chairman.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from St. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I now am informed that the delegate from Pembina, Mr. Rolette, has been a bit more than temporarily delayed. In fact, I'm informed he has returned to his own community of Pembina.
And the opponents of the capital removal bill had put it over. The sergeant-at-arms was directed to find the delegate from Pembina and bring him to the council chamber. The council chairman, who opposed removal, shut off all attempts to dispense the bill and prepare a new copy. And the council remained in session for 123 hours. Cots, blankets, and baskets of food were brought in. And the question of the hour, where is Joe Rolette?
Why, I heard that Joe went to his old hometown at Prairie du Chien. Has some kinfolks down there, you know. Guess he got plumb lonesome to see him.
Well, I heard it. Poor old Joe ain't even with us no more. Yep, he was assassinated. Got himself bushwhacked by some Injuns.
The hours wore on, and at last on Saturday, March 7th, close to the hour of midnight, adjournment time for the territorial legislature, a few seconds before midnight, in strode Joe Rolette. But it was too late. The council chairman banged down his gavel and declared the council adjourned for that session. The members from St. Peter, those favoring removal, were bitter in their anger. But the residents of St. Paul, they were overjoyed, ecstatically happy. There was a torchlight parade for Joe Rolette on the spot. He was wined and dined, and the grateful citizens of St. Paul gathered together a $2,500 purse and presented it to Joe Rolette, the man who saved the capital for St. Paul. And only then, many years later, did some of Rolette's closest associates tell the story. Joe had actually lived in comfort in the top floor room of St. Paul's Fuller House, His companions, a few members of the legislature, kept him well supplied with food and wine and played cards with him every day while the entire legislature was asking the question, where is Joe Rolette?
Intrigue of this kind was even more common on the local level. And many are the people who fought bitterly with pitched battles and midnight forays and stuffing of ballot boxes in the fight for the county seat. There was the fight between Graceville and Ortonville, Glencoe and Hutchinson, Shakopee and Jordan, South St. Paul and Hastings, and others. The alley fight between Frankfort and Austin turned out to be more than just a battle for a county seat. It was a struggle for existence. And now the once thriving frontier community of Frankfort has vanished from the map. Austin, the county seat, has grown to be a large, important city.
And in state politics, the worst fears of the Democrats were realized. Alexander Ramsey, with the help of his chief lieutenant, Ignatius Donnelly, was elected governor in 1859, wresting control of the state from the Democrats for the first time. And from that time until 1904, the Republican Party dominated Minnesota politics. These were times that called for men able to cope with the problems of a Minnesota that was growing fast, changing with incredible swiftness from wilderness to industrial state. Men like Alexander Ramsey, Cushman Davis, and the great Knute Nelson, who served in the United States Senate. There was William Windom, a congressman and secretary of the Treasury, and John Sargent Pillsbury, a businessman governor who accepted the idea of government regulation of the railroads moderately administered. These were men of ability of foresight, leaders who arose at a time when the state was passing from primitive living to culture, from trade with the Indians to the huge mining and lumbering industries. Yet men and women equally determined, equally honest, opposed and fought them. The revolt of the farmers and the battle over county option. You'll hear about them on Minnesota Milestones in just a moment.
One apple won't make a harvest, but put one apple on top of another in a barrel and pretty soon you have a winter's supply. Why not store up security for yourself in the same manner by putting $1 after another into a savings account? Of course, you'll want a safe place to save, and Twin City Federal will provide that, plus liberal dividends to help you reach your goal faster. Twin City Federal accounts are insured for safety up to $10,000 by a permanent agency of the United States government. The current dividend rate is 3.5%, and those dividends are compounded quarterly, too, added to your account 4 times a year. Twin City Federal is conveniently located at 8th and Marquette in Minneapolis, 6th and Robert in St. Paul, and there's free parking for you right at the door. There's also convenient save-by-mail service for you out-of-towners. People all over the Northwest are building for the future through thrift at Twin City Federal, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. Join them soon. You're listening to the 32nd Star on Minnesota Milestones from your centennial station in Minneapolis and St. Paul, WCCO.
The Machine Age. It would be dramatic indeed to say that it burst upon the scene in Minnesota, but it didn't. It crept in gradually, only slowly, reluctantly dropping the old methods and turning to the new. But the machines clanked ever louder in the growing cities. The rattle of the reaper and the snort of the threshing machine spread slowly over the face of the land. Two sons of pioneer farmers sit on the town board now, Tim Flaherty and Gunnar Olson. The talk is still about the fence lines and the roads, but now there is talk of machinery, too. And the debate, it went on ceaselessly, endlessly in town board meetings all over Minnesota.
Oh, I don't know. Well, I think it's a pretty fair bid. Well, I'm in favor of buying a new Austin Western Motor Patrol.
Now, look, Tim, $10,000 is an awful lot of money. We can get a new blade for about $500.
Well, yeah. Then spend more time fixing the thing with baling wire than we do scraping roads. You know, Gunner, ever since we was kids and our pa sat right here on this board, they talked about fixing that sinkhole in the road down by the creek. Well, it ain't been fixed yet.
Well, we've been trying.
Oh, sure. We've been having washouts, too, every spring. If we dug that out and got one of them new iron culverts in there, why, we wouldn't have any more washouts. We need that new motor patrol.
In those days of expansion, there was too much boom, followed by the inevitable bust. The country growing too fast, bursting its britches. The farmer learned cooperation from Oliver Hudson Kelly in the Grange. He joined the Farmers' Alliance in the 80s and the Populist Revolt in the 90s and the Greenback Party. And along came Ignatius Donnelly, brilliant, cantankerous, fiery, vituperative. Donnelly started his political career as a Republican with Alexander Ramsey. He then became a Democrat for a time. But most of his political life, he was in the forefront of third-party revolts in Minnesota. His pen was as eloquent as his voice, as he wrote in his newspaper, The Anti-Monopolist.
In the South, they keep men away from the ballot box with shotguns. We can't quite do that. The farmers might shoot back. But we corrupt their representatives. It is a great deal easier and makes less noise. It is a clean, sweet, nice transaction. So many dollars for so many votes.
And the populists achieved some success at the ballot box. In some elections, they forced the Democrats into a third position. The Railroad and Warehouse Commission was established, government stepping in to demand fair play. The populists faded slowly from sight in the 90s. Changes had been made. The farmers had learned the value of organization. They were to be heard from again.
It was one of the great men of Minnesota politics who turned the tide in favor of the Republicans back in the 90s, stopping the Populist Party in its tracks. Knute Nelson. His election was a milestone in Minnesota history. He was the first foreign-born governor of Minnesota, and the foreign-born citizens of the state flocked to his side. Nelson suddenly announced that he would be a candidate for the United States Senate. Senators were elected by the legislatures in those days, not by the people. And Nelson won out over Senator William D. Washburn. He went to Washington, and Lieutenant Governor David Clough took over as governor.
Ignatius Donnelly lived one day past the turn of the century. Alexander Ramsey died shortly after. The old-time political leaders who had been in control during territorial and early statehood days had all departed from the scene. And a new political era was dawning in Minnesota with the coming of the 20th century, a turbulent era. Ever since pioneer days, temperance crusaders had traveled the length and breadth of the state, preaching the evils of demon rum. The debate waxed hot and heavy until in 1866, the Republican Party incorporated a proposal for local option in its platform. It was a clear-cut, wet versus dry fight in the race for governor, and the Republican candidate, Andrew R. McGill, defeated Dr. A.A. Ames, Democrat, political boss, and often mayor of Minneapolis. The fight to push county option through the state legislature began there in the early 1900s.
This country will not be a fit place for women and for children until the evil of strong drink is removed forever. Oh, the pity of the husband and father, reeling, staggering home after leaving his wages in the hands of the clutching bartender. His wife and children ragged, miserable, hungering, and in want. Local option won't do. We want no option. We want prohibition. Complete, total prohibition.
The Wets wanted a wide-open state, no restrictions on liquor. And so in the Minnesota legislature of 1915 came the showdown on county option. The bill passed the Senate 36-31. The crucial test came in the House of Representatives on February 24th. Debate raged on for 9 hours. The galleries were packed with men and women. House Clerk Arneson read the list of A's and nays and handed the paper to Speaker Flowers. And then...
The roll being called, there were 66 yeas and 62 nays. The bill is passed and the title agreed to.
Having gained this victory, the dry forces pressed on. County option was never a success. Most of the counties rejected it, and it was not until Congressman Andrew Volstead of Minnesota introduced the act which bore his name. Not until the Prohibition Amendment was approved in 1919. Only then did the temperance leaders and the Anti-Saloon League prevail, for a dozen years anyway.
Minnesota produced many outstanding political figures in the 1900s. There was Governor Samuel Van Sant, who battled the great Jim Hill to a standstill over the issue of merging the Great Northern with the Northern Pacific. There was Robert C. Dunn, prominent in the Minnesota legislature. And then there was perhaps the most beloved Minnesota governor of them all, John A. Johnson. That Johnson won out at all was a miracle back there in the campaign of 1904. It was the year Theodore Roosevelt was running for re-election as president. Robert Dunn was the Republican nominee for governor. Roosevelt was immensely popular, and it looked like a shoo-in for the Republicans. But because of questionable methods used by Dunn's colleagues, when the final votes were counted, John A. Johnson, the Democratic St. Peter newspaper editor, was the winner over Dunn by 7,800 votes, while Teddy Roosevelt carried Minnesota by 160,000 votes. Minneapolis, normally a Republican stronghold in those days, got its revenge on Bob Dunn by voting Democratic. Johnson's was a Horatio Alger story, if ever there was one. He rose from a childhood of poverty and a boyhood of hard work to a young manhood in a rural newspaper office. And then, another milestone in Minnesota politics. John A. Johnson became the first native Minnesotan to govern his state. In 1907, there was a miners' strike in northern Minnesota, a strike which tested the leadership of Governor Johnson.
Governor, I think we should take no chances at all. You know as well as I do, the leaders of that strike are real firebrands. They'll stir up some real violence, just as sure as I'm sitting here. I think we should call out the National Guard.
No, I don't think I want to do that. Call out the National Guard and we serve notice on the miners. We don't trust them to be good citizens. I'll tell you what I'm going to do, though. I'm going to the Iron Range and talk to those miners. Tell them how important it is that they keep peace and order.
Governor Johnson did just that, and there was no violence. The strike was soon settled. Governor Johnson traveled widely, spoke all over the nation. In 1908, his name was prominently mentioned as Democratic Party nominee for President of the United States. Johnson very likely would have been nominated for the presidency at the Democratic National Convention in 1912. He might have been President of the United States in place of Woodrow Wilson if he had lived. But on the 15th of September, 1909, John A. Johnson was taken to the operating room of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester to undergo surgery for an intestinal ailment. It was an operation from which the governor never recovered. He seemed to rally, but on the afternoon of the 20th, he began to sink. No one had told him that his last hours had come, but the governor knew as he lay in that darkened room with his wife, Nora, at his bedside.
Well, Nora, I guess I'm going. But we have made a good fight, haven't we?
Yes, John. A good fight. Oh, my dearest.
The governor said nothing more, but from time to time stroked Mrs. Johnson's cheek. At 3:25, the morning of Tuesday, September 21st, Governor John A. Johnson died. Never before was grief so widespread throughout Minnesota. Men and women wept unashamedly in public, on the streets. 50,000 persons were in that sad funeral procession that wound through the streets of St. Paul. The whole state stopped to mourn as a special train carried the governor's body to St. Peter for burial. Even the warships in faraway New York Harbor dropped their flags to half-mast that day. Everywhere in Minnesota, all across the nation, men and women knew they had lost a leader, a man who had earned their faith, their trust, a man of justice, a man of strength.
In a few moments, we'll hear the battle for woman suffrage, the rise of the Farmer Labor Party, and about another great governor, Floyd B. Olson.
One of the most rewarding tasks we can devote ourselves to is the education of our children. And certainly one of the easiest ways to assure them of money for college is with a Twin City Federal Savings Account. Start one soon if you have youngsters, and as young minds grow and mature, the money will be growing with which to help them through college. You always earn liberal dividends at Twin City Federal, where the current rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly, and where your money is always safe. Insured for safety by a permanent agency of the United States government. Yes, indeed, if you have youngsters, start a Twin City Federal On to College Fund for them sometime soon. Build for their future through thrift, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature, and where there's plenty of free parking for you right at the door. Or you can take advantage of Twin City Federal's Save by Mail service wherever you may live. That's Twin City Federal, the $250 million savings institution, so conveniently located in downtown St. Paul and Minneapolis.
Among other things, politics reflects changing times, changing conditions, change brought on by prosperity and depression, war and peace. Politics reflects changing populations, changing districts, changing attitudes. And in the township where the Flaherty and Olson family settled so many years ago, there was change. The cities, the suburbs slowly pushing out, swallowing the rich farmland. Homes and shopping centers and highways springing up like corn in the hot July sun. But now it's winter, the snow covering the new suburb and its freshly painted houses. And the annual town meeting is in session.
I don't quite understand what Mr. Olson and Mr. Flaherty hope to accomplish, except to oppose everything modern we're trying to do. They fought us on the sewer and water issue. When we wanted paved streets, they fought us on that. And now that we want to incorporate and get the advantages that other suburban communities have, they're fighting us again.
We didn't ask for this change. Houses, paved streets. We like this country the way it was. It's farmland.
We know that, Mr. Flaherty. But do you mean to say that just because our fathers or grandfathers didn't settle here, we don't have any rights?
Sure you got rights, Mrs. Arnold. We've admitted that.
All right. I hope you get your village. And I hope something a lot more important. I hope you learn how to run it.
And the 1900s brought other changes, too. By 1912, 10 states had equal suffrage rights for men and women, and in 21 other states, including Minnesota, there was partial suffrage for women, suffrage won under the leadership of women like Dr. Ethel Hurd, Mrs. Andreas Euland, Carrie Chapman Catt, and Maybeth Hurd Page.
When Mrs. Frank Leslie had her will was probated, and it was found that she had left the bulk of her fortune of about $1 million to Mrs. Catt to use for suffrage. That was the turning point.
At last, in 1920, the fight was won, and the required 36 state legislatures had ratified the 20th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Women had the right to vote. But the battle was not over. Many men who had bitterly fought the suffrage question were asking,
all right, you got the right to vote. Now, what you gonna do about it?
Leaders of the newly won suffrage fight saw that something must be done. The women must be urged to take an active part in politics and in government. So in 1920, the League of Women Voters was organized and spread across the nation. In 1923, the first women ever to run for office in Minnesota entered the campaign for the state legislature.
I remember that Mr. L. Erickson came out and shook hands with me and spoke favorably of my filing, and I thought it was a very simple and pleasant thing to do, and that there was absolutely no reason why women should hesitate.
And Mrs. Page continued to serve the 30th District of Minneapolis in the legislature until 1944, one of the great ladies of social progress, of the law, of good government, and of politics in Minnesota.
Change and the new liberalism continued to spread across the land. It spread from New York and from Wisconsin, from North Dakota into Minnesota. It was President Theodore Roosevelt, Robert M. La Follette, and A.C. Townley who helped to bring changes in the old order, profound influences on politics in Minnesota. Minnesota liked Teddy Roosevelt, but disliked William Howard Taft, who sought to return to the old conservative order. The insurgent philosophy had taken root in Minnesota and could never again be ignored. Minnesota went Democratic, supported Woodrow Wilson for president. The opposition was bitter, but progressive legislation still was forced through the Minnesota legislature. Workmen's compensation, initiative and referendum, more railroad regulation. And the men who battled in this period, the men who fought for control, Governor J.A.A. Burnquist, Charles A. Lindbergh Sr., the legislator from Little Falls, Frank B. Kellogg and Moses Clapp, who had represented Minnesota in the Senate since 1901. But it was A.C. Townley who was destined to leave a mark upon Minnesota that would last for many, many years. A.C. Townley, the political heir to Oliver H. Kelly and Ignatius Donnelly. Townley, who read disappointment in the faces of the farmers and who proceeded to make political capital of it. It was a change that enabled Townley and his nonpartisan league organizers to go from farm to farm and talk to the farmers. That change, the automobile.
Hello, Townley's my name. Art Townley. You're Tom Reston, aren't you?
Yeah.
Hauled your grain into town yet?
Yeah.
Get your price?
Do we farmers ever get our price?
Now that's what I want to talk to you about. Frankly, I'm trying to sell all farmers on the value of organization, political organization. Now, that's the only way we'll ever get our price.
The League spread like wildfire there in the 1900s. In the election of 1918, it supported Lindbergh Sr. against Burnquist for governor in a primary campaign of unbelievable violence. Opponents of the League called it pro-German, un-American, anti-war, and socialistic. Its meetings were broken up, its leaders jailed. And Burnquist won. In the general election that followed, the League cooperated with the Minnesota Federation of Labor in supporting David Evans against Burnquist, and for the first time, the name Farmer Labor Party appeared on the ballot in Minnesota. The Farmer Labor Party didn't score that year, but in 1922, it elected Henrik Schibsted to the Senate. With Farmer Labor support, Magnus Johnson came within 14,000 votes of spoiling Governor Price's bid for re-election. Johnson won the race for the Senate in 1923 when Senator Knute Nelson died. And the Farmer Labor Party had two senators and two representatives in Congress, O.J. Qualley and Knute Vifald. But the high tide of the Farmer Labor Party was yet to come, with its champion, Floyd B. Olson. He first came to public attention as Hennepin County attorney back in the early 20s. Graft and corruption were exposed in City Hall. A number of aldermen were tried, convicted, and sentenced. For Floyd B. Olson, that was the beginning of a colorful, turbulent political career. A career that led straight to the governor's chair and might have led far beyond. Throughout the entire troubled, depression-ridden years of his administration, Governor Olson constantly battled the warring factions within the Farmer Labor Party. He called the leaders of those factions the Mexican Generals. It was in the 1934 campaign that Floyd Olson launched the most controversial program of his career. Many will remember it.
We propose a cooperative commonwealth as an ideal society under which the federal government would own and operate public utilities and key industries, and under which other businesses would be largely carried on by producer and consumer cooperatives. We advocate this system of society in order to bring about a more equitable distribution of the fruits of the labor of mankind to all the people.
But by 1934, Governor Olson showed signs of weariness over the constant criticism that naturally was leveled at him from private business. He was tired of the constant bickering among the Mexican generals, never agreeing, always quarreling, squabbling, fighting, and maneuvering. In the past, Olson had very carefully handled details of the state convention himself. But in 1934, his increasing weariness began to show. Then he announced that he planned to go to Washington.
But, Governor, you can't do that. You gotta stay until we get the platform written.
Those Mexican generals must learn to do something for themselves eventually. They may as well start now.
In one of his many broadcasts, Governor Olson spoke out in favor of President Franklin Roosevelt's attempt to pack the United States Supreme Court. Here is an actual recording of Governor Olson's voice.
It is not the jurisdiction of the court that I challenge here, but its use of that jurisdiction and its abuse of that jurisdiction that I here challenge. The claim that this tribunal is one merely of powers is erroneous. It is fundamentally and essentially a tribunal of men. Not necessarily of powers, but primarily of men.
Olson was re-elected for the second time, but he looked forward to 1936 when he planned to run for U.S. Senator against Tom Shaw. That great political battle never came off. Senator Shaw was struck and killed by a car on a highway near Washington, D.C. A few days after Senator Shaw's death, Governor Olson went to the Mayo Clinic at Rochester for an exploratory operation. The surgeon's verdict, an inoperable cancer. Olson managed to conceal this from the people of Minnesota during the spring of 1936. In one final amazing display of strength, he spoke 2.5 hours before the Farmer Labor Party State Convention. But he retired to Gull Lake after that. His health failed rapidly, and he returned to Rochester. Then at 6:29 p.m., on August 22nd, 1936, at the Mayo Clinic, he rallied briefly, recognized those about him.
It must be for the best. Be sure to pay the hospital bills and take care of the nurses' pay.
Those were the last words to come from the lips of Minnesota's great liberal governor. 2 hours later, he was dead. Those who saw the funeral will never forget. The funeral cortege passing out of Rochester to Pine Island, Zumbrota, Hayder, Cannon Falls, Hampton, Farmington, to Rosemount, to West St. Paul. Citizens stood bareheaded, lining the streets all the way. More than 200,000 persons paid their last respects to Governor Olson at the state capitol. Then on Wednesday afternoon, thousands jammed the Minneapolis auditorium, filling it to overflowing. They spilled out into the streets for blocks around, listened to the funeral services through loudspeakers. Rabbi Aaronson of Minneapolis spoke, read the 23rd Psalm, and then delivered his own personal tribute.
Truth sits silent until there are lips to speak it. America has its ideals. It takes men of the courage and character and personality of Floyd B. Olson to realize them. That is why we feel so keenly and mourn so deeply his premature passing. Let us be thankful, however, for the years we had him with us.
The invocation was delivered by Father John Dumphy, pastor of the Church of the Ascension, and a personal and lifelong friend of Governor Olson. The funeral oration was delivered by another great liberal of the 20s and 30s, Governor Philip F. La Follette of Wisconsin. Following Governor Olson's death, his Farmer Labor Party fell to pieces.
The voters have never stood for political bossism in Minnesota. And never was that fact more dramatically illustrated than in the election of 1938. In 1936, Elmer R. Benson, the last of the old Farmer Labor Party governors, was elected by a margin of 248,000 votes. Yet, only 2 years later, he went out of office, buried under 291,000 votes. And the winner, Harold E. Stassen, the 31-year-old county attorney from South St. Paul, the youngest governor in Minnesota's history, told the legislature in his inaugural address,
"One of our first and most important problems is to raise the standards of public service and to improve the morale of state government. Much can be accomplished in this regard for better service by the executive branch of the government alone. We will take those steps."
And the steps were taken, with an administrative staff of men so young they were known as the Diaper Brigade, and with a cooperative Republican legislature behind him, there was an outburst of legislation such as the state had never known. The keystone of the Stassen program was civil service, and Harold Stassen instituted businesslike control of state finances, so that not one penny of public money could be spent without a public accounting. Stassen won 3 times, and the 3rd time he did something no other governor has done before. He declared that, if reelected, he would serve only 4 months and then resign to join the Navy. He asked the voters to elect Edward J. Thigh as lieutenant governor to take over the governor's office. In recent years, we have seen the pendulum swing once again through the Republican administration of governor and now Senator Thigh, Luther W. Youngdahl, and C. Elmer Anderson, to another era under the merged Democratic Farmer Labor Party of Governor Orville Freeman and Senator Hubert Humphrey. And these are but the newest names in the passing parade of men of all parties whose lives are indelible marks in the record of Minnesota politics. Others in that memorable panorama were Hjalmar Peterson.
He served as governor during the 100 turbulent days following Olson's death.
Thomas D. Shaw, the blind senator.
The only election I ever lost was the one I was sure of winning.
Senator Magnus Johnson.
Only about half of those lies they're telling about me are true.
Congressman Melvin Maz.
The fighting Marine who lost his sight but courageously carried on his career of public service.
Congressman August Andreessen.
The strong voice of the dairy farmer during nearly a lifetime in Congress.
Governor C. Elmer Anderson.
The soft-spoken successor of Youngdahl, who overturned his party's leadership in the legislature.
Senator Ernest Lundeen.
The last voice that Minnesota isolationists sent to the Senate.
Congressman William Pittenger.
Probably the most colorful character Minnesota ever sent to the halls of Congress.
Congressman Walter Judd.
The missionary doctor who brought his healing philosophy to U.S. foreign policy.
Congressman Harold Knutson.
Who rose through congressional ranks to leadership of the Ways and Means Committee.
Governor Horace Austin.
Whose name is proudly perpetuated in the thriving city of Austin, Minnesota.
There was a whole array of colorful governors. Stephen Miller, C.K. Davis, Adolph Eberhardt, and L.F. Hubbard. And there were others whose names will be remembered for their service to Minnesota in the legislature. In addition to those already mentioned, there was Mike Holm.
One of the longest and most distinguished careers in Minnesota state government.
Oscar Swenson.
A farmer without legal training whose horse sense made him a natural leader in the legislature.
Roy Dunn and John Hartle.
Conservatives whose leadership is still a strong force in state affairs.
John A. Johnson.
The namesake of an early Minnesota governor who served as Speaker of the House 3 terms.
H.H. Flowers.
A fiery and aggressive legislator who also served 3 terms as Speaker.
Robert Sullivan.
Powerful orator, able legislator, and staunch defender of the state constitution.
Claude McKenzie.
Strong proponent of good roads for Minnesota.
Charles Munn.
A farmer who served as Speaker of the House during 2 terms under Olson.
Lawrence Hall.
Under 3 governors, he served 5 sessions as skillful Speaker of the House.
These were some of the men who added luster and color to the story of politics in Minnesota over the years. Not all of the prominent figures in Minnesota politics were officials in the state capitol, in the legislature, or the city hall. Some were the writers and reporters, men like Joseph Ball, who later became United States Senator, Charles Cheney, and there was the late beloved Mike Halloran, well known wherever political leaders gathered.
The question was raised, Senator, about generating plants. If
That question comes up in the next Congress, assuming you go back. Will you support appropriations for generating plants?
And that was the actual voice of Mike Halloran, a voice now forever stilled, but a voice that will live in the memory of Minnesota politics and government.
Is there any man now alive who can look 100 years into the future to see the problems facing the governments of Minnesota? Where is the man so wise, so knowing that he can plot the course for political leaders, establish the guideposts for the years to come? Who can point to this man, that woman, and say, "You are the chosen one"? Our leaders of the years to come may be anywhere. The political genius, the leader of the future, may be yet unborn, may lie there in his crib at your side. He may be serving his first term in the legislature. He may be the new county attorney. The Floyd Olson, the Theodore Christensen of coming years may be on the farm or toiling in the factory. Today, at this hour, the John A. Johnson, the John Sargent Pillsbury, may be a merchant, doctor, dentist, miner. A future great senator, a Knute Nelson, may be at this hour poring over his books, preparing tomorrow's lessons for school. Government and politics, these you cannot buy so much down and so much per month. They cannot be mined or manufactured, constructed or cut down, for they exist in the minds of men. Minds that guide ambitions, wills, and skills in handling public issues when they arise. Minds with the ability to think and to compromise. The ability to win, to lead, and to sacrifice. And above all, the desire to serve. Under our system, the democratic system, not perfect, but still the best devised by man, under our system, as each crisis presents itself, there waiting will be men and women trained and ready, able to cope with the problems a mature Minnesota will face in the next 100 years. This we know, even though our vision be dim, our eyes unable to imagine the milestones that lie ahead in Minnesota's second 100 years.